From advertisements to health practices, fat people are often discriminated against and denigrated based on their body weight, shape, and size. Advertisements on TV or in magazines promote weight loss products to consumers that encourage people to lose weight in order to conform to what society deems an acceptable body size. Overweight individuals also face discrimination in the medical community. Insurance companies often refuse to provide them with coverage. Overweight people may be encouraged to go on diet plans or even undergo surgery to lose weight. Marilyn Wan experienced this discrimination firsthand. On what she calls her really bad day, her boyfriend told her that she was embarrassed to introduce her to his friends because she was fat. On the same day, Wan received a letter from her insurance company informing her that she would not be able to purchase health insurance due to her morbid obesity. Instead of succumbing to discrimination, Marilyn Wan became a fat activist, promoting a positive body image and a healthy lifestyle. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking your question during the question and answer session at the end of this program. And now, please join me in welcoming Marilyn Wan.
So I have to thank all of you here at Dickinson for your kindness and generosity in inviting me here, and also your bravery, okay? Because there are a lot of places that couldn't manage this, and even inviting me or attending this event. So I want you to give yourselves an applause for your heroism. And I'm seeing this room full of people and a second room full of people. Hi, second room full of people. I love you in there. And in here. Okay, so whatever room you're in, give me an F.
F.
Give me an A.
A.
Give me a T.
T.
What does it spell?
Fat.
Okay, so now let's try saying it on the count of three, really loud and proud from the belly. Okay? So that people out on the street go, what's that party? We want to go there. Okay? Count of three. One, two, three. So I love that so much. I would have flown on the red eye here to Pennsylvania from San Francisco just to do that. And one reason that I really love the F word, the really powerful one, right? Because that other F word, you might be thinking about it, lost its like edge in the mid-80s. But the reason that I love this F word is because for the first 26 years of my life, I was way too afraid of that word to say it. I grew up in Southern California. I was a chubby kid, a little bit larger than average in high school. Actually, I thought I was the biggest person on the planet because I weighed like 165 pounds. And I was, in Southern California, horribly fat by that culture's definition. And I was treated very differently. And my way of getting through living in a society that treats fat people differently is, at that time, was just to try to avoid the whole topic. You know, because then maybe I wouldn't get treated badly or feel bad. So I didn't, for example, wear sleeveless clothing. Because if someone saw my bingo wing, like the world would end, right? In England, they call it a bingo wing, that flappy bit. Isn't that cool? Bingo! Now you get it, right? And I didn't try out for like the school play or do dance or whatever. I did the school newspaper instead because you didn't have to be thin to run the school newspaper, evidently. and I was trying to be a good student, and I kind of went about my life that way until I had what was just described to you as my really bad day, right? Kind of a double whammy, both on a social level with my friend and on an institutional level with insurance. On that one day, I was told, nope, you are a fat person and no fatties allowed, right? And I'm inspired by so many other groups of people who have resisted prejudice. And I'm inspired by the poet Audre Lorde, who says, your silence does not protect you. So I really hope you read Audre Lorde. But also, had my silence protected me all those years if I didn't say the word fat, nothing bad could happen to me? No, because I was living a limited life, needlessly limited. And I was going along with being excluded from a lot of things. And so I decided if I wasn't going to be silent any longer, I had to speak out publicly. So I came out as a fat person. Big secret, right? Now, most of the time, I think fat people do not identify as fat people in our culture. Instead, I think fat people say, I'm not really fat. I'm not always going to be fat, right? People say, I'm going to lose weight. They make some efforts to lose weight. They talk about their body as if it's a bad body that they want to improve. And that's a kind of tithe to the system. And then they can kind of get by. They can kind of be good fatties because they're working on their weight problem, right? I don't think anybody has a problem. I think somebody has a problem with my weight, right, in our society. Not necessarily any individual, but our society creates messages and meanings and judgments around weight. So I came out as a fat person, and that's one reason I really love the F word, fat. Partly because I had lived in fear of it so long, and reclaiming it was liberating, which is a political choice that people in fat pride community make, to kind of take back a word that has been loaded with negative implications. And also because it's really the simplest, least judgmental word for the subject, I would argue. Short and tall, young and old, fat and thin. Certainly we put lots of judgments on all of those little words, right? But it doesn't have to carry those meanings unless we put them there. What are the other words that we use in our society to indicate a fat person other than the F word? And I'll repeat whatever people say so that people watching this will know what people are saying and be able to hear it.
Obese.
I've heard that one. What else?
Chubby.
Big bone.
Big boned.
Overweight.
Any other kind of nicey-nice terms for it?
Hefty.
Fluffy. As if I were filled with air like a big balloon. Thick. I love thick. Huh?
Chunky.
Yeah. And then there are these kind of odd ones like, gravitationally challenged or something. A person of size. Do you have a size? Everybody is a person of size, yes? I'm sorry, not just you. So let me break down my feelings that I have in response to those words and what I think they carry and what I think we may or may not agree that we want to say when we use them. And so I offer it up to you for your own consideration, how you might want to pick and choose your words to make your own world more livable for your own body and for other people. So the word obese. Does that sound like a diagnosis? It sounds kind of medical, yeah? Can you diagnose anything about a person by weighing them? Can you necessarily be sure of anything? I'm seeing a lot of heads shaking no. I object to the word obese for a couple reasons. First, I don't think it's a medically meaningful thing to weigh someone and make assumptions about their health or how long they're going to live. Based on the data, when I look at it, when other people who are starting to question, who are like medical experts, look at it, they're like, huh, we don't really see why this is a category that's supposedly diagnostic. Also, based on my personal little story, why would I object to the term obese? Related to, yeah? Yeah, because of my insurance. Because I'm not allowed to have any. I think it would be good for my health to be able to go to the doctor and get a pap smear or antibiotics, right? I'm not allowed to because of that word. So that's dangerous, I think. And I'm not the only one. A lot of fat people, even those of us who happen to have insurance, are facing denial of access to medical care because of our body weight. We're also being targeted for cures for our body weight. So on the one hand, you can't have an MRI. On the other hand, you can have your stomach amputated. So that's my reaction to the word obese. Overweight. Is that a judgment? Yeah. I'm seeing some heads nodding yes. The word itself makes it sound like there's a correct weight, and it also makes it sound like that correct weight applies to everyone equally. It's the same correct weight for everyone. And that's what we experience when we compare our bodies to a height-weight chart or to the BMI. We're comparing our bodies as if there's a right weight and a wrong weight, and it's the same weight across the population. Is that true? Are we ever all going to be between 130 and 150 pounds? Everyone? So why do we use words that make that sound like that's a utopia or a desired world? I mean, we don't say over height. If you're not between 5'7 and 5'11, doom. Anyone over 5'11, sick, you're going to get sick, you're going to die. You know, we don't talk that way about height, but we talk that way about weight. Was that a hand in the back or just a moving? You have a question?
No.
Oh, no, it's just you were moving. Okay, cool. So the word overweight is a judgment that I disagree with, both because it makes it sound like there's a right weight for everybody, and I don't think that's ever going to happen to human beings. And because even though I understand people use the word overweight to be polite, and I really appreciate the intention of not hurting anyone's feelings, I don't think that's the word that does that. The other words I would group as euphemisms. Can anyone give me a kind of a definition of what euphemism means? It doesn't have to be perfect. Yeah. Excellent. The definition we hear is that it's a euphemism is a nice way of saying something that's not nice. And that's really elegantly short and perfect. Because it's using a euphemism to indicate a fat person is indicating also that there's something not nice that there are fat people or about being a fat person. And because I kind of want to expand the possibility of celebrating weight diversity, because I don't think it's actually a bad thing that there are fat people and thin people and people of all sizes and heights and types and colors and sexualities and everything. I don't use euphemisms as fun and cute as they sound. I might say someone who weighs more than average because that's kind of like a mathematical way of saying something. But I certainly never say someone who's got a normal weight, because what's my normal weight, what's normal for my body, is certainly not the normal weight for who do I want to pick on? I don't know. Who's a thin, famous person?
Jessica Alba.
The normal weight for Jessica Alba's body is a different weight than the normal weight for my body. Now, if I tried to weigh like Jessica Alba, I would be doing the usual thing in our society. It would supposedly be good for me, right? What if we said to Jessica Alba, your body is not a normal weight. You should try to weigh like Marilyn to be healthy. That wouldn't be good for her. It's not good for me to try to weigh what Jessica Alba weighs. It's not my nature. So I don't use the euphemisms either. And I think that if we're going to kind of look at the way our whole society thinks about weight and assigns meaning and messages, the first step is just kind of looking at the words we use and what they carry with them. So I don't think there's necessarily anything negative in the word fat unless you put it there. Now, there's also a power dynamic about who gets to decide what your body is called. So I don't necessarily go through this room and say there's a fat person, there's a thin person. You get to define your own body. I encourage you to kind of own it for what it is right now and be happy with who you are. But I'm not going to say, oh, you're a fat person, you're a thin person, because I don't know how you want to identify. The government does that, right? They have charts like the BMI and stuff. They decide who's fat and thin. They use the O words, the categories of overweight and obese. But basically the majority of people in this country are told by our own government that we weigh too much, right? We'll get to other places of like how people define us later on. But what I'd like to do with this crowd and anyone who can yell really loudly from the other room is what I call a kind of a brainstorming exercise. I call it speed anthropology. So I've got a little whiteboard here. And what's going to happen is that we're all going to pretend to be anthropologists today. Although, are there any actual anthropologists in the room? Anybody in this room? You're an anthropologist? You're not going to have to. You're studying anthropology. Awesome. Anyone in the other room do anthropology? We're free of anthropology in the other room. So this is, no anthropologist will be harmed, and I don't even know if this is anthropology, but what I suggest that we do, in an attempt to kind of map our cultures, our modern American cultures, messaging around fat and thin, is I suggest that we find kind of cultural artifacts in the language that attach to the words fat and thin. So not synonyms, not other words for fat or other words for thin, but other ideas that get attached to them. So I've done this speed anthropology a number of times over the years, and if you come up with an artifact, a kind of a word, a brainstorming idea that I've never heard before, I will do a happy dance. Yes, there will be expressionist dancing. Also, I acknowledge that this is sometimes kind of a touchy subject. You don't want to hurt people's feelings. If anyone says something very brave, because it could be taken the wrong way, I know you're not talking about me. You're doing anthropology. So I will do a happy dance for those brave suggestions. So given that, I suggest for the next 5 or 10 minutes or so, we do speed anthropology around the words fat. Am I going to fall off here? No. I can go all the way over here. I feel like Eddie Izzard prancing around like a giraffe in my boots. Anyway, maybe I'm more like a rhinoceros. Okay. So here we have fat, here we have thin, and I'm going to write down your anthropological artifact finds. What have you come across in your experience of modern American culture? Words that attach, concepts that attach to fat or to thin? Yes?
Diet.
For which one? For thin? For fat?
I guess
both. Okay. Diet, it doesn't have to make any sense. Diet goes on both sides. You have a good pen. Here, we're gonna make the word fat really fat. Yay! No one can see the anthropology. It's invisible ink. So far, and I'm sorry, other room, I have my back to you. I'm gonna go like this. Fat and thin. What words do attach to fat?
Sloppy.
I love it. In the back? Lazy. Love the lazy.
Glutton.
Super awesome on the glutton. I think lazy and gluttonous get a special dance. They get like a waddle dance. Okay, what else?
Embarrassing
for the fat side, right? Or are you just talking about my dancing? What about for thin? What concepts do we have attached in our culture?
Beautiful.
Wait a minute, I got a hand up here too. Beautiful supermodel, not just the regular model, the supermodel. What about you, someone over here?
Fashion.
Healthy, unhealthy for thin. But do we also have healthy for thin?
No, unhealthy.
Hungry for thin. Someone in the other room thinks thin people are hungry. So we have unhealthy here and anorexic. Do we have healthy or unhealthy for fat?
Unhealthy.
But could we also possibly have healthy for thin? Yeah, so I'm going to put like a little slash. Un/ healthy. You guys know what it means. Who else?
Fit.
For the thin. Excellent. Do we have a fitness idea over here?
Unfit.
Not athletic. Attractive. For which side?
Thin.
So we've got beautiful, we've got attractive.
Bony,
yes. I don't want to miss the bony, which I'm putting on thin under my assumptions. Yes.
Normal
under thin. Excellent comment. I very rarely get that, so you get a little Broadway jazz hands. What else? Yes.
Obnoxious.
Under thin. I try so hard. Excellent. Yes.
Jovial.
I love the jovial. Or sometimes if it's Santa, it's jolly. What else?
Weird
for thin. What dance can I do for that? I've never gotten weird. I'm going to do like a little... Excellent. In the back? Restrained. What about, I'm going to ask in some categories, like, do we have any food concepts that attach to fat or to thin? Salad and McDonald's. These are the number one answers. Now, I am guessing that the McDonald's goes on the fat side, the salad goes on the thin side. What beverage do we have to go with? Water and Diet Coke on the thin side. Diet Coke on the thin side. Let's just wrap our minds around that for a minute. Supersize over here. And milkshakes. And beer. You notice how they never call it diet beer? They call it, like, light? Because, like, guys drink beer, and so they don't want to drink diet beer. Because, huh? What? Drive-through. Yes. All the food that I eat comes from a window. So handy. So we have food concepts. We have supermodel and fashion, but do we have actual pieces of clothing that we associate with thinner bathing suits? Skimpy?
Bikini?
Thong? Plus size? Over here. We don't have minus size for the thin, isn't it? But we do have skinny jeans. It's kind of redundant. A thin person wears skinny jeans.
Lane Bryant.
I call them plain giant. Any other clothing over here, like a specific clothing item?
Sweatshirt.
The muumuu, the sweatshirt. Sweats. What about furniture? Do we have any furniture associations or any?
Couch.
Yeah, I always feel really grateful to my thin friends because they have all this space in their house taken up by a couch that they never sit on. They just have it for me. So, huh?
Treadmill.
That's the furniture over here, right? What about socioeconomic status? Any associations? Fat, thin?
Poor, rich.
Poor and rich.
So over here, poor. Working class.
Over here, rich, also uneducated. There's another word for that, starts with an S. The stupid. And I have to do a special dance. If you can get the other S word for fat people that's like about hygiene. Smelly. Someone was super brave. I'm going to do like a Rocky dance. Because if I can get stupid and smelly people to say that, I am so happy. Makes me so happy. I feel like I've done a good job with my speed and throw. Over here we have fit, we have beautiful, we have... Oh, what about sexual activity? Any concepts that attach? Okay, so over here, none for sex, and all the sex. And you would go the other way. Sex, and no sex. Yeah. So, really, these things can be very contradictory. We can argue about them, or we can just agree that both are true, which is also true. Are there any animals associated with fat or thin?
Elephant.
Hippo. Pig. Whale. There's one that gives milk. Cow. Rhino. Wait, what? The sloth. I will do a dance to thank you for the word sloth. Was that a good one? Okay, over here, do we have animals or objects? What animals?
Gazelle.
And jaguar. Giraffe. That's why Eddie Izzard is always running around the country dancing like a giraffe. But also, are there object terms, like on the playground, that thin kids get called? Stick. Toothpick, and beanpole, right? There's a lot of stuff here. Any other comments that people want to make? Any other artifacts that you might have come up with as an anthropologist? Sick in the head. So we're, sick in the head. Our emotions are off, right? What other emotions than jolly and sick in the head do we have for fat? What? Sad. The other room says sad. And oh, it's so true. Any other emotions for fat? Funny. Stressed. And what?
Insecure.
Insecure. Uncomfortable.
Isolating.
Or like lonely, right? Huh? Guilty. What emotions do we associate with thin?
Happy.
Successful, which is not an emotion, but it certainly is nice.
Smug.
Powerful. Nice. What?
Self-control,
for sure. I can't write backwards. I'm sorry. It's like... Okay, over here, do we have something like that's the opposite of self-control or confident for fat? Well, we have gluttony, out of control, no control. Undisciplined. I love that one. How many people here at Dickinson read Foucault? There were three whole people. Yes. So I want to stop the speed anthropology here because you all have done brilliant work as anthropologists. If someone were trying to get a PhD in anthropology, they could use this as a very rich data set, a rich finding, right? And they could write their dissertation on this. There are all sorts of things that I want to point out about this map that we've drawn together. First, good job. Yay. So this is a kind of a quick and easy map of modern American culture's messaging around fat. And one thing that I noticed, there's several things I want to notice, and then I want to get us all talking about it. One thing that I noticed is that groups that have been marginalized in history have all faced a similar list of stereotypes, and that's like stupid, smelly, lazy, ugly, out of control. So this is not necessarily innovative. Some of it is. You know, McDonald's. Innovative. Over here on this side, it's also kind of a classic list. Smart, rich, successful, sexual, attractive, fashionable, healthy. We get healthy and unhealthy, very big messaging around weight in our culture. So this is not necessarily a new binary system. What other groups have we kind of done these kinds of divides? What characteristics have we divided people over before? Like men and women. What else? Over race, which we kind of invented, right? And is it, yeah, not so much a fact. Yeah? Sexual status or, you know, who you have sex with. Yeah. In the back?
Religion,
for sure. Lots of religious stereotyping and prejudice going on.
Smokers
and non-smokers. Yeah. Physical ability. Class. The rich and the poor.
Immigrants.
And people who were here earlier. So I'm actually making a claim that this fat and thin divide is a form of what?
Discrimination.
And if you had to come up with an adjective to describe this picture that we just drew, what would you call it? How does it strike you? Well, like okay, we'll call it discrimination. So I could come here and tell you that there's weight discrimination, or you could show me a picture of it and name it yourselves. Yes? Cool. How do you tell which side of this line you're on in our society? Who tells you? The media definitely tell us who's fat, who's thin. Who else? Your parents will tell you. Your peers definitely tell you whether you're fat or thin. Your doctor. The insurance company. Clothing stores. Yeah, in the back. We always say that. So these are the classic ones, right? Basically, anywhere you go and everything you do will tell you whether you're fat or thin. Right? Actually, there was a car ad for the Mini Cooper in a billboard where I live. And it said, it just showed a picture of a little car in the middle of a blank billboard. And it had the words, 100% fat free. Now, I just want to point out that in the last 20 years or so, Americans have gained about 15 pounds on average, each one of us, more, you know, if you spread it over everybody. And cars have started weighing like 700 to 1,000 pounds more each car, right? So when we talk about the obesity epidemic, I'm not sure it's human beings that we should be worrying about. It might be our vehicles. So we hear it from a lot, and it really, it's high stakes which side of this line you're on, right? Because either you're smart and sexy and get to wear a bikini and have friends and be popular and have money, or you're stupid, smelly, lazy, unhappy, depressed, unhealthy. It's really high stakes. And the line moves around, yes? Whether you're fat or thin, especially if you're in kind of the middle of the bell curve of weight distribution, can really, you know, you can get different answers depending on which authority you consult or which clothing store you go into. And how you know in a clothing store whether you're fat or thin is if they don't have any clothes that fit you and they stop having clothes that fit, say, women at about the size of the average woman. So they're not really about maximizing profits. They're kind of about maximizing scarcity and our freak out. Yeah, which maybe maximizes profits in some really weird backwards way. So this line moves around a lot. So is it a fact, this line? Or is it kind of just fiction? Maybe it's not a fact. Maybe it's not true. Maybe it's kind of false. Is it beneficial, this line? Does it do anyone any good? I'm seeing shaking heads no. So people are saying it's not a fact and it's not helpful. Is it necessary, this line between fat and thin? Do we actually really need it for something? Do we? No. I'm seeing no, we don't need it. It's not true. It's not helping us and it's not necessary. So we could erase it. Would anyone like to help me by erasing, symbolically erasing the line between fat and thin right now? Would you like to?
Well, no.
Yes. Okay, so somebody is benefiting from this line existing. That's an excellent point. Before we erase it, we better look out who our enemies will be. If we start to erase it, they'll be redrawing it, right? And actually, you're anticipating my whole next point. Who wants this line? The government?
Capitalism?
The media? The weight loss industry? The fashion industry? Do our mothers want this line? No, I think they've just been influenced. Maybe some of our mothers want this line. People are saying a lot of really good things. This line has been put here, not necessarily by you and me and our friends, but by kind of large forces in our society, yes? And so if, and it's very true that one should be warned before one goes erasing lines that the man might like, which I don't mean any particular man or even men in general, but, you know, like... the big forces in society. We better know what we're up against, and it's really not as easy as my symbolic, you know, with the eraser and the line. But nonetheless, I'm going to tempt all sorts of retribution and erase this. Everybody kind of got it in their line, in their mind. Oh, if you encounter unhappy experiences because you happen to be on the bad side of this line, if you are unhappy and don't have any sex and have no bikini, or perhaps have a health problem. What is the answer that most of the time to those problems we're told would answer them? I think perhaps, right? Just jump over the line. Diet, lose weight. People are saying diet. Wouldn't everybody be thin then? Wouldn't we have tried that and done that? So does dieting make people, fat people turn into thin people? No. People are shaking their heads. No, dieting does not make fat people turn into thin people. Excellent. So I'm going to erase this whole picture because I actually kind of worry about exposing people to this picture because I feel kind of morally responsible once I've exposed you to a picture of discrimination. You know, I don't want to leave you with nothing to do to protect yourselves from that, you know? And the thing that reassures me is that One thing that reassures me is that I have something to help us protect us from that. But also, that I'm not the first one to expose you to this. I think we've all kind of encountered it in our daily lives, going on about, you know, being our diverse weights and everything. And I think the thing that I felt on my really bad day was that I was the only one being picked out, singled out, isolated, and that everyone else belonged and had some kind of secret of being a real person, and I was less than a real person. But what I keep finding is that, in fact, that experience that I had, pretty much everyone has had some kind of thing like that. And so, in fact, we all have felt like we're all alone in the face of this map of discrimination. Yeah? So I just want to write a number. This is the good pen. This is a large number, yes? Oh, here, I'll draw it properly. What is that? 58,600,000,000. I feel like Austin Powers, but those were awful movies. Every year in the United States, we spend 58, here, say it with me, $58,600,000,000 to cross over that line. And in fact, this number is more than it was the year before. And when I first started doing this work in the mid-90s, it was $40 billion. And I thought it was big then. I actually went on an imaginary shopping spree with $40 billion to see what I could buy. Instead of weight loss products, because if we spend this money every year to lose weight, and the next year we still spend more, is the money we're spending a good investment? Is it producing the return we expect? Oh, no, people are saying no. So I went on this shopping spree, and in my book, there's a chapter called Opportunity Cost, where I say some of the things that you could buy. You could take everyone on Earth out to see a movie. You could fund 97 Dickinsons for a year. You could put, who wants free college? Who would like free tuition for college? Yes, I would like. You don't want free tuition? Okay, maybe you already have free tuition. I don't know. Anyway, so with the amount of money that we spend every year trying to jump over the line from fat to thin, trying to wear a size smaller jeans, we could put 1/3 of all high school graduates through college for free. And then what would that do to our economy? Good things, right? What does this do to our economy? Nothing. It just makes money for Jenny and Dr. Phil and, you know, sometimes Oprah. So we're paying a price. Not only is that line not a fact, not only is it not true, not only is it unnecessary and non-beneficial, but we're actually paying a lot for it. And this is not all we're paying. Weight discrimination exists in the workplace, and so every time a fat person is not working to their full potential in life, our economy is missing out. Every time someone has an eating disorder and they're not doing something else wonderful with their life and they're having to spend a lot of money on the therapy and the support that it takes to resolve that eating disorder, that's a cost, yeah? And it's a really tough experience. So we're paying an incredible price, both in terms of money and in terms of kind of human life energy, aside from eating disorders, just like everyone who's worrying about where they are in relation to that line. So it's not really just fat people, it's people on both sides of the line worrying about where they are in relation to the line, yeah? So, so when you come across an example of that line being drawn, there are really kind of two choices. It's like a forking path. You can choose to agree and help redraw the line and kind of try to be on, you know, the good side of the line, which is understandable. Everybody wants good stuff in life, right? And I support everyone getting all the good stuff in life. I just don't think there should be a weight prerequisite for it. So health, happiness, sex, bikinis, good jobs, success, money, a couch. I want that for everyone, right? So you have the choice of trying to conform to fit this discriminatory system, or you have the choice of questioning the system and saying, I would rather erase that line than redraw that line. And it's actually really very daunting to do that in the middle of a society which everyone agrees that that line is just the niftiest thing. There are very few topics where we all agree in this country. But I was just thinking the other day about it, and it's not just that Rush Limbaugh and Al Gore agree and say all this stuff, right? It's that Ralph Nader and Rush Limbaugh agree. And I actually think there's an incredible amount of pressure on all of us to agree to this picture that I just drew, because we have pretty much unanimous agreement in this culture. So it's, we're going up against like a lot of people agreeing. I have another observation to make about that picture that we drew of discrimination, which is that wherever I go, whether I'm talking to 8-year-old Girl Scouts or corporate executives at Chevron, I got to go to Chevron and talk about this stuff. So odd. I didn't say the car thing at Chevron. I should have. Anyway, and I talk on college campuses all around the country. I've talked to people from England about this stuff. I get all of the same responses. So you're in college and you're learning stuff. Does it take effort to learn new stuff? Yeah, I'm seeing some yeses. You study for a test and then you maybe know some of it better. We have all learned this with 100% knowledge, right? Which means that we spent some time and effort learning it. It means that our culture is actually teaching it to us all the time. So we're going up against a huge thing. But that's what actually makes it really more fun, to be a really awesome rebel, you know? And a rebel for what I would say is a really good cause. I would say that the cause is to have all of us be at home in our bodies. Because if you can't be at home in your own body, where are you supposed to go? I mean, that's one that I just don't quite get. So I like being at home in body, in the body embodiment, the liberation of us from that alienation from our own embodiment. So there are going to be some really big, bad, meanie concepts that one might encounter, in addition to the weight loss industry and the government and the entire fashion industry. If you're going to be a body-loving rebel, there are a couple concepts that you're going to come across, and it really helps to have some kind of skepticism about these concepts, because the concepts are presented as if Ralph Nader and Rush Limbaugh all know that they're true and they're impossible to question. So the first concept is a notion of choice around weight, right? The second concept is a notion about health equaling weight. And then the last concept is kind of an aesthetic argument. Now, in the years that I've been standing up and saying, hi, I'm fat, I'm happy, I'm healthy, if I'm unhealthy, I deserve medical care for that, not for my fat. In the years that I've been saying these things, I've gotten these three big arguments against my position. The first argument is, the answer to your problems is to lose weight. You could be thin. All fat people are choosing to be fat. All thin people are choosing to be thin. It's a choice. Who's heard this line? Anyone heard this line? Yeah, a lot of people have heard this line. Is that true? So if we look at the medical data, when they look at medically supervised weight loss interventions where people eat less and exercise more, what percent of those people do you think permanently lose weight? 3%. Do I hear any more? 1%? No, that's less. 5% of the people who eat less and exercise permanently lose weight. Do I need more than 5%? You are a well-informed audience. You have been reading the medical literature behind my back. Because, in fact, 95% of people who lose weight by eating less and exercising more will regain it within 2 years, 3 years maybe. So does that mean that all of the people who diet are doing it wrong? Or does that mean that perhaps the approach of trying to make people thin by eating less, exercising more, is not going to produce the result we think it is? Yeah? And so it's not actually that the dieting is wrong either. It's just that our bodies are designed to maintain what's a normal weight for our bodies. In the scientific literature, that's called set point range. And as soon as people identified that as a concept, the weight loss industry started funding all of the obesity researchers. These are sarcastic quotes, right? Obesity researchers to say, no, that can't be, right? So it's actually in the literature, but it's hard to find because our obesity researchers always talk about weight loss. Instead of trying to make everybody be thin, I like the idea of focusing on health as if it were a different thing from weight. I don't think, here's the radical thing that I would say. No, not so much. Health doesn't really equal weight. And if we want to talk about health, I think something that's really good for health is to like your own body. Because then you treat yourself well, and you do things because you enjoy them, not because you're punishing yourself for not fitting into a pair of jeans. So there's an entire medical community of people who used to do the weight loss approach and who found that they were really sad to be doing something that didn't produce the result of making people thin and also seemed to be harming people both physically and psychologically. And so they developed something called health at every size, which is a kind of a paradigm shift. If you're reading Thomas Kuhn talking about science and beliefs in science, Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, there's a notion of a Kuhnian paradigm shift, and I really want one from a weight-based focus in healthcare to a health at every size, weight-neutral focus in healthcare, both because the health at every size approach makes people healthier and because it supports social justice. It supports ending and erasing that line between fat and thin. And if you have a weight-based approach to healthcare, you're definitely redrawing and supporting a system of discrimination based on weight. So the health at every size approach says love your body, enjoy food, and enjoy being active. This is what I would call a pleasure principle, as opposed to the punishment principle of the weight loss or the weight focus. So the weight loss method says, if you're fat, you're bad. And to punish you for being fat, we're going to make you exercise and eat less. You're going to be hungry, but you should appreciate the punishment, right? And you're going to have to eat stuff you don't like vegetables. Anyway, so I would call that a punishment principle. Does anyone ever really enjoy someone going like this to them? No. And it's not really something you want to embrace and adopt in your life. So as an example, has anyone heard of someone who makes a New Year's resolution to lose weight? People have heard of this. Awesome. And that person says, I will eat less, and I will exercise more, and I will lose weight. Now, we already know that that's not going to be a lasting result. But is that person still doing those behavior changes the next January 1st? I'm seeing shaking heads, no. Are they still doing those different behaviors by the summer? Maybe not, probably not. What about by the middle of February? Maybe, yeah, maybe. And so we have a chocolate holiday to help people stop dieting. I would say that if people are doing something they don't enjoy that feels like a kind of punishment because they're being told that they're bad, we can probably tolerate that for about 5 or 6 weeks, and then we rebel. We don't enjoy that, and so we go against it. And so telling people to lose weight is a really good way to make people not do health-enhancing behaviors for very long and actually stop them. So instead, there's a piece of research that compared that approach to the health at every size approach, and what they found was that people had like a 6-month period of being told about health at every size, being told, you know what, if you're hungry, eat something. If you're full, stop eating. and that the ultimate authority is your own body cues about these things. And it helps to know a little bit about nutrition, because McDonald's is probably not as nutritious as something you cook at home with vegetables in it, right? But McDonald's is still food, you know, and don't only live on McDonald's and don't only live on broccoli. So that's a health at every size approach. And then around fitness, you know, find something you really enjoy doing. So, for example, what vegetables do you all really hate you never want to have to eat them again? Cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, awesome. What vegetables do you really love? Celery, asparagus, carrots, do you use spinach, zucchini? So do you have to eat foods that you hate in order to be healthy? No. You can eat foods that you really enjoy. Now, who knows better whether you're hungry or full, your own body or some guy named Phil? Because he's not my doctor, so I don't call him Dr. Phil, right? Right? I mean, when do we finally get to be adults who know what we, who both know about nutrition and know what we can do to take care of ourselves? We live in this world that treats us like we're not even three-year-olds, right? You should eat this, you should eat that. There's an entire section of the bookstore that treats you as if you don't even know how to eat, right? So that's the health at every size approach about nutrition. What about exercise? What exercise activities do you really hate and you don't want to have to do them? Running, basketball, Stairmasters. So what physical activities do you actually really like? You do them because they're fun. You can't stop you. Dancing, yoga, rock climbing, golf. What? Basketball. She hates it. You love it. More for you, right? So do you have to do something, some physical activity that you hate and you dread every minute of it in order to be healthy? No. You don't have to. You don't have to? Okay. Can you do something that you enjoy and that will keep you healthy? Why, yes. If you enjoy it, are you likely to do it for the rest of your life and then you get the health benefits of it? Yes. In fact, the Health at Every Size research finds that the pleasure principle is actually far more effective at changing people's behavior for the better and then at producing better measurements in terms of blood pressure, cholesterol, blood sugars, those kinds of metabolic numbers that help predict health. So in the research, people had either 6 months of weight loss or 6 months of health at every size, and then they were followed up at 1 year and at 2 years. And first of all, the weight loss people, 40% dropped out because it was no fun to begin with. The people who stayed lost a little weight, had some health improvements, had some behavior changes, and then they regained all the weight, went back to the way they had been behaving, and had no lasting health improvements at 1 year and 2 year follow-up. The only lasting change for the weight loss groups was that they were a little more depressed. Why would that be? You know, obviously. For the health at every size group, at 1 year and 2 year follow-ups, they continued to have better behaviors in terms of eating and exercise. They continued to have health improvements. They lost no significant amount of weight, and they had less depression and were more self-esteemed. Right? So which would we choose if we seek health? Which method? Would you choose to focus on weight, or would you choose to focus on a kind of a love yourself, treat yourself well approach? Maybe the second one. I'm just saying, there's kind of some data that would sway me, in addition to the fact that it sounds like way more fun. So those are the arguments that you're going to come up against. Also an aesthetic argument. We just don't like fat people. Thin is inherently beautiful. Is that true, or is that just what we've kind of learned? It's cultural. So I don't want to say that thin people are ugly. I think thin people are beautiful. But I raise my pudgy fist, and I say fat is beautiful, which gets a lot of laughs sometimes in some circles. And I'm inspired by some quote that I think Gandhi may have said, where he says, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they oppose you, and then you win. And so it's actually really good if I get laughs, right? Because that's better than being ignored. And we're moving along to fighting about it and then winning. And so this beauty aesthetic and the aesthetic of who is a person, who counts as a person and who is not quite fully human, something that comes up with that line, because that line is really drawing, like, who do we count as a person? So those are some responses. What are some kind of situations where you might encounter something that's about that line between fat and thin. If you've come across it yourself, or if you've seen something in the media, or the current debate about healthcare reform. Yeah, in the back. Airline seats are very small. They're smaller than that chair. Raise your hand if you're uncomfortable when you fly on an airplane. Yeah, like everybody, practically. So currently, most of the major airlines have a policy where if a fat person comes up to the gate and they've bought a ticket for an airplane flight, the gate agent can look at them and say, you look fat, you look like you won't fit in one chair, you have to pay double to buy a second chair, or we won't allow you on the airplane. And there's really no law against that because there's really no civil rights protections for fat people except for a couple places. Michigan, a couple cities. In San Francisco, where I live, we worked to get some height-weight protections. So when I look at the architecture of an airplane, I see that if you pay a lot more money, you can sit in first class. But the width, there's a lot more leg room in first class, but the width of the seat is not actually that much wider. Instead, there's a giant unmovable table between the two chairs. So where I would like to put my fat ass, there's a table. Excuse me, I'm in the Midwest, I should say, my rear end. So in coach or economy or whatever I can actually afford, the chairs are narrow, they don't have much leg room, but if you want to, you can pay a little more money and get more leg room, right? Like you can sit on the exit aisle, you can sit on the bulkhead row, there's ways that you can pay a little bit more money, certainly not double, and you get a little more leg room. When I just flew here, there was advertising in the airport that said, pay a little more and get 5 more inches of leg room. 5! I want to be able to buy hip room. Just one row where the chairs are wider, and I pay a little bit more. That would be awesome. But our airplanes don't build their architecture to accommodate wider people. They only have an option for some taller people. And instead of all of us passengers who are uncomfortable on airplanes rising up against the airplanes and saying, you need to figure out how to make money and do it in a way that doesn't make us feel awful when we sit in your chairs, they're doing what's called divide and conquer. So it's a classic strategy. When factory owners wanted to oppose workers who wanted more money, they would spread racist comments so that the workers of color and the white workers were divided against each other and didn't join together to fight the factory owner. So this is divide and conquer, and it's dividing the fat passengers and the thin passengers. And the airlines are actually advertising bigotry, right? They're saying, you're a thin person, you deserve your chair, and you shouldn't have to sit next to a fatty. We feel your pain at having to sit next to those dirty, smelly, lazy, ugly, gluttonous, out of control, moo-moo-wearing fatties. Right? And then they get passengers who say, I was oppressed by the fat person sitting next to me who spilled over into my chair. I don't want his chair. I want my own chair. I actually don't want to touch the bigot. Right? I don't actually think he's a bigot. I just think he's a person who's been exposed to our culture, right? No one of us is responsible for all of these thoughts. We're all saturated with them. I have fat-hating thoughts in me, you know? And it's just where we live right now, but we can all kind of try to notice it and try to go, ugh, get rid of that. Ooh, get it off me, you know? And that's really cool to do. So if you had never noticed weight discrimination before, not unusual. Now that you've heard about it, see what you can do to mess it up. So that's my answer to the airlines question. What do you think? Does that answer it, or is that a different way of analyzing the situation? Yeah, okay, cool. I mean, I want the airlines to make money. That's fine with me. What are the airlines actually doing? Yes, they're actually disbarring fat people from the airplane unless someone ponies up extra money at the gate. And it's very traumatizing. I've heard from a lot of people. And people have tried to file lawsuits. Sometimes they prevail, and more often they don't. So there's no requirement for the size of the chair in federal regulation. So you're buying passage from point A to point B, but you're not necessarily guaranteed real estate. So they're saying they're selling real estate. I'm saying they're a hospitality industry selling a service, and they should be nice to people, and I'm a human being. But right now they're acting like I'm not a human being the same way a thin person is. Yeah. Man. So let me just summarize. Yeah, it's a reverse. Yeah. So someone is talking about an article in a women's magazine. How interesting that it was in a women's magazine here, which is often a source of policing our bodies to thin conformity. And it was an article about Mauritania in Africa, and how the standard of beauty there is for women to be fat, and how women there, young women, eat a lot of food to gain weight, and they go to this place where someone beats them to make them gain weight. Yeah, that's exactly a reverse of our situation here, and it seems, and I think it's very strange and kind of creepy that it's always like Africa, you know, some place that we exoticize and, you know, have lots of kind of probably racist notions around, and that we can look at that behavior as extreme or strange or kind of unacceptable. Because it's the opposite of our own situation. People are being encouraged to gain weight. I certainly wouldn't. I actually oppose people trying to have a weight gain goal just as much as I oppose people having a weight loss goal. I don't think fighting your own body's basic natural size is a good idea for health or for justice. So, yeah, it's like a mirror image, a reverse mirror image, and we can see how messed up it is in the reverse. But does it help see how messed up our own stuff is, or what do you think? Right.
So it does just kind of like make you realize the absurdity of it all. It's like, wow, this culture thinks it's beautiful. We think it's beautiful.
So you're saying, I'm just repeating this because I guess it's being recorded and the microphone helps, that thin women in Mauritania are treated horribly with hateful, hurtful comments, and they're discriminated against, and that it's a whole absurd situation. And we can see the absurdity when it's reversed, and so it helps see how absurd this stuff is. And that's true. A lot of what I deal with is just absurd. Why should I identify as a fat person? It's not really that interesting a characteristic or a thing to talk about. But in a fat-hating culture, it becomes political and something that I want to claim with pride, even though I don't actually think there's a line between fat and thin, right? So it's a really strange little floating signifier. Any other questions, comments? Yeah. You, yes. Yeah. Oh, should we start doing the mic thing? Yeah, please do.
If you could wait for the microphone to reach you, that would be great as we're recording.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Is this on? All right. I just have a question. How closely correlated is, I guess, the movement that you're trying to get off the ground with the movement for people maybe eating healthier in general, because it seems to me that this health at every size thing kind of lets corporate food industry pretty much get away with letting lower class people keep eating fast food and basically giving them garbage.
Right.
And like, yeah, I guess that's my
question. I think that's an important question. I would refer you to my favorite health at every size author, who just wrote a book called Health at Every Size, The Surprising Truth About Your Weight. She comes from a social justice perspective about weight discrimination, but also a social justice perspective about food. And so her work really tries to combine those two awarenesses. I don't think they're at all mutually exclusive. I think they should be mutually supportive, because in the same way that I want to be at home in my body, I want to be at home in an environmental and an economic world based on justice and a world that treats animals respectfully and not cruelly if we are going to eat them. And I also think that like a local production of food is more sustainable than the kind of giant businesses that kind of go global. I wouldn't say it necessarily has to let the food industry off the hook. What I do say is that I'm not an activist on behalf of the food industry. And I think those critiques are all really important to make, as long as they're not made on the backs of fat people. So, for example, the movie Super Size Me makes a lot of really good criticisms of McDonald's. I wish they could do it without making fat jokes or saying the reason to be concerned about the environmental impact of McDonald's is because fat people are fat. You know what I'm saying? So it's important, and I'd refer you to Linda Bacon's book. Her name's Linda Bacon, and she's a PhD out in San Francisco. Who's next? You guys get to choose who's next. Microphone power.
Clearly, you've done a lot of, I think, great legwork in dealing with the vanity issue. And I understand your explanation of health and how you should be healthy in your own body weight. But how would you address people who do consider themselves fat, who have things like diabetes or heart disease that come as a result of maybe high cholesterol from eating poorly or something along those lines?
So I would pick apart some of the things that get conflated in that kind of a comment. What we know from the data is that the majority of fat people, 7 out of 8 fat people, are not diabetic and never will be. What we know is that diabetes is a process that can actually produce weight gain. So it may be that people get diabetic and it makes them fat. In a review of every possible autopsy research looking at body weight and atherosclerosis, meaning the fat in your arteries, there was no correlation between total body weight and atherosclerosis. So if fat people are correlated with a higher risk for heart disease, I don't necessarily think that it's the body fat causing that. It could be a confounding variable like history of dieting, poor nutrition, lack of fitness. Experience of stress and discrimination in life definitely can produce heart disease, barriers to health care. So I don't think we've really picked apart all of those things. What we do know is that when fat people get heart disease, we survive it better than thin people. So there are actually ways that being fat is protective. Fat people are less likely to have osteoporosis, and we're less likely to have lung disease for some reason. Let's see, diabetes, heart disease, what else? When I generally think about correlation, I try to make sure that we don't assume that it's causation. So, for example, a colleague of mine points out that men tend to get heart disease more than women do, and it's in part because of higher levels of testosterone. Higher levels of testosterone also can cause hair loss. But if we tried to reduce heart disease in men by giving men hair implants, it wouldn't necessarily change their heart disease, right? And so it's the same situation with fat people. If fat people are more likely to get heart disease, making fat people thin is not necessarily the thing that's going to be the lever that makes people healthier. Good nutrition, regular exercise are definitely direct contributors to better health. And the wonderful thing is whether or not you lose weight from those behaviors, they're doing you good in your health. Was the last little bit of that? I've forgotten. Okay, next question.
Going back to the issue of insurance, do you know if individuals who engage in like risky behavior have to pay a higher price, like someone who rides a motorcycle or a smoker or just someone who's in like a dangerous profession?
So I don't know if motorcycle riders pay more for health insurance. I've never heard of that. I do know that smokers are sometimes targeted for paying more for health insurance. I think that the analogy, the important thing to point out is that smoking and motorcycle riding are behaviors, and that being fat is not a behavior. It's kind of a bodily characteristic. But I also would oppose having anyone pay more for health insurance based on something that we do in life, because I think riding a motorcycle or smoking are kind of free choice. And I think that insurance should be a pooled risk where we all pay a little bit and we all get taken care of. Those are my politics.
Hello. I think while you make some good points, I'm a little perplexed. When someone gets to a certain weight, I've seen in stores where people have to use wheelchairs and things like that. So at what point does someone become so extra heavy, overweight?
Beyond some weight.
I'm sorry, I don't know what to say. I'm sorry. So when someone becomes so overweight that they cannot function in life, for example, the heaviest man in the world, Manuel Uribe, in Mexico, where he sits in a bed all day, that's not a healthy lifestyle. He might be happy, but that's not a healthy lifestyle. So at what point is it okay to where you're overweight and you can function, to where you're so overweight that you have to use, that you have a bigger car, you have to use an elevator to get into your van, that you can't function as a normal person? What's the tipping point?
Well, I'm not willing to imagine that we live on like a flat world with a weight horizon, and if you go beyond a certain weight horizon, you just drop off into non-existence. So, and I also am very inspired by disability rights activists, so I wouldn't say that someone who uses a wheelchair or any other assistive device is not normal or is not living a worthwhile life. It's not up to me what people weigh, but I think that the health at every size approach is beneficial and non-harmful for people at all weights. And so for the very fattest person you can imagine, and for the least mobile person that you can imagine, and for someone who has the most health problems that you can imagine, I would give them the same advice, and I would want the same thing for them that I want for an average weight person. I would want them to have a healthy, happy relationship to food, eating in response to internal cues of hunger and satiety. I would want them to have a healthy, happy relationship to physical activity that they can do. So some of my friends who use wheelchairs do activity in the water, and that's their physical activity, and it's really good for them. I wouldn't say that jogging would be good for a 400-pound person, right? So there are things that our bodies can do, and I think we should treat them with respect and do the physical activity we can do. And I would want, for people of all size, respectful medical care that focuses on our actual health concerns and not our weight. Because even for the very fattest, least mobile, sickest person, dieting isn't going to work. And in fact, that person may have gotten into that situation by losing 10 pounds, gaining back 25, losing 30 pounds, gaining back 50. That would be my response, is that I it's not up to me whether that such a person exists, but I want for them good things and not bad things.
I don't understand when you say that, like, I understand that cholesterol and diabetes.
Thank you, cholesterol. I forgot cholesterol. Okay, yeah.
Well, that they might not be directly correlated with being fat, but when it comes to the point that being fat, you can't run like we were talking about, that you get so out of breath, or that you can't lift your hands over your head, or that, like, your joints are affected because of your weight, and that you have back problems as a result of being fat, that it just seems like it's not healthy. So even though you might not have diabetes or high cholesterol, it still seems that being fat has a bad negative effect on your body, like a natural body.
I hear you. So the cholesterol point, which I totally forgot, is that I don't remember exactly about cholesterol. It may be that fat people have higher cholesterol. I don't know, but half the people who get heart disease have normal cholesterol. So cholesterol is not really a measure that I think of as being the most important measure, and we have excellent drugs if someone has high cholesterol to lower it. So in the same way with blood pressure, I think if a fat person has high blood pressure or high cholesterol, they should try eating well and exercising joyfully for their own sake, and if those health-enhancing behaviors don't take care of it by itself, often these things are genetic, that people inherit high cholesterol or high blood pressure, then drugs are there to help. And I would want a fat person to have access to those drugs like a thin person. And in terms of like osteoarthritis and things around joints, yeah, some fat people get more of that stuff, but we don't have a way to turn fat people into thin people. So saying that's unhealthy, yeah. So I hear from people who are told, you know, we won't do a knee replacement operation on you because you're too fat. So we'd like to do weight loss surgery on you and do what I call stomach amputation, gut lobotomy, digestive bonsai, you know, gastric guillotining. I come up with a lot of names that I think are more accurate. And so they're very eager to do that surgery, and it's perplexing to me. Like, okay, you can't have a knee replacement because you're fat, but you have to have your stomach off in order to get the knee replacement. So it's kind of blackmailing. So I have a fat friend who wanted to be here today, and she tried for 3 years before she could find a surgeon who was willing to do a hip replacement for her. And she actually healed faster and recovered better than the average patient once she finally got it. So that's sad for me that it took her 3 years to find a surgeon who would do a thing that actually ended up being no trouble at all. So let me also deal with the notion of correlation between higher weights and illness and death. In the medical literature, when you do epidemiology, illness is called morbidity, and death is called mortality. So it's like morbidity, mortality rates. There are, for fatter people, correlations to higher rates of morbidity, mortality. But that doesn't mean that the fatness caused the morbidity, mortality. And in fact, research that looks at other variables, confounding variables, can sometimes erase that correlation. But let me break it down a different way. I'll do the turkey story. So another colleague of mine tells the turkey story. Let's say it's November. It's November. The weather starts to get colder if we don't have too much global warming. And turkeys die in huge numbers at the same time as the weather gets colder. This is an intense correlation, absolutely high correlation. We could say the cold kills the turkeys. Are we missing a variable that might have an influence on turkey mortality? Sarah Palin kills turkeys in November. Now, perhaps there's also a festival of turkey eating during November, right? So I would call the festival of turkey eating, Thanksgiving, the confounding variable that interrupts the meaningfulness of a correlation between cold and turkey death. In the same way, there's a researcher named Steve Blair, and he used to run the research program at the Cooper Institute for Aerobics Research in Dallas. And he's tested like 75,000 people for their fitness level, what they weigh, how healthy they are, how long they live. It keeps track. And his research is the only research that, in addition to looking at the correlation between weight and morbidity, mortality, adds in what I would call a confounding variable of fitness. Okay? And what he finds is that the thin people who are sedentary are 3 times more likely to die young than the fat people who are moderately fit. Right? So that it completely disrupts the correlation with this one confounding variable. Fitness is a very powerful influence on health, regardless of weight. And fitness is a wonderful thing that you can increase. Even if you're fat, you can start being physically active in a way that works for your body. And if you haven't been fit before, you can still do it, and it'll have a health benefit. So for someone who can't raise their arms, or for someone who huffs and puffs and is aerobically unfit, we can access fitness, but we can't reliably turn fat people into thin people. So that's how I would pick apart those kinds of concepts. And I would definitely refer you to Steve Blair's work and also to Linda Bacon's book, which also talks a lot about how conflating weight and health is not really health-enhancing.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question.
Oh,
I want a good one. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to take the last question?
I'm wondering if you've heard about the legislation in Japan in which people whose weight measurement is over 35 inches...
Oh, their waist, yeah.
Yeah, their waist. They have to pay fines and undergo counseling, which is like a government-mandated program.
Yes, I've heard about it.
If you think that other countries are moving in that direction, or if you know of any other countries in which things like that happen.
Yeah, Singapore has had a really draconian weight policy, and teens in Singapore now have vast amounts of eating disorders because of it, so it's really scary. In Japan, a couple summers ago, they instituted this kind of rule where if your waist is above a certain circumference that you could be fined, your employer actually would face fines. And I don't think they've actually started to impose the fines. If you know about that, I'd be really interested. Because at the time, I started a little MySpace page. People were still on MySpace before Facebook. And I invited people to make... I figured out how to make one of those little origami cranes, except instead of the usual one, a friend of mine figured out how to make a fat one. And so I invited people to fold fat origami cranes, and we would send like 1,000 fat origami cranes to Japan. So in my living room, I have a big pile of 1,000 fat origami cranes, and I would love some help figuring out how to, in a culturally respectful, highly media-friendly way, get my cranes to fly to Japan. As a kind of way to suggest that perhaps health at every size would be a good thing in Japan, too, and weight discrimination is scary. I don't know. What do you think? Do you have friends in Japan? You're not big in Japan? Okay. Is that really our last question? Thank you.
On behalf of the Women's Center and the Clark Forum, please join me in thanking Marilyn Wan again.
Tell them to step on this.
Okay, this is the yay scale. And instead of giving you numbers to weigh you, it gives you compliments.
To find out what you yay.
To find out what you yay.
So it'll be back in the room as you leave.
It's going to be in the back if anyone wants to try it out as you leave. And this concludes tonight's event. Thank you for coming and have a good night.